frequency, radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth has never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision fly by helicopters in the night. Attempt triangulation of our...
And welcome to this Monday edition of A Public Affair. I'm your host, John Quinlan. For the next hour, we're going to be talking about food with Winona Howder. She's the executive director of Food and Water Watch, and she's worked extensively on food, water, energy, environmental issues, and local levels. And we're going to be specifically talking about this in the context of her book, which is called Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America. It's a book that examines the corporate consolidation control over our food system, what it means for both farmers and consumers. Winona has been experienced in developing policy positions and legislative strategies. She's also a skilled and accomplished organizer, having lobbied and developed grassroots field strategy and action plans, both as director of Public Citizens Energy Environment Program in earlier work, and also she was environmental policy director for Citizen Action. Winona, welcome to A Public Affair.
I am so glad to be here today.
It's so good to have you here. And we should mention at the outset that you're here in Madison in the context of a book reading and a program that's happening tonight at the Goodman Center over on the east side, 149 Wabisa Street. And that's beginning at 7 tonight. And we're hoping that the snow won't scare people away. But as we were pointing out, this is Madison, Wisconsin, so I think we'll be fine. But it's great to have you here. I wanted to maybe start with you. I was asking a little bit about your background and where you'd grown up. In the introduction to the book, you talk about a lot of these developments in the context of a family farm that you grew up on, about 40 miles southwest of Washington.
Yeah, about 45 miles southwest of Washington in the Plains, Virginia.
And when you were growing up, very different environment than what's there today, right?
Yeah, absolutely. My dad and mom were missionaries, and we ended up in Virginia, and my dad thought it was time to get back on the farm. In those days, there were only two-lane roads going into Washington, and it was very remote. And we actually had a mile-long dirt driveway that was very rutted. It was a very different world than it is today.
And today, it's surrounded by suburbia, especially.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Well, on one side, they've just put in a new Walmart 4 miles away. On the other side, we have quite a few very wealthy people that have been able to keep development from affecting their estates. So we still live in a partly rural area, but big changes.
And you're still running it as essentially a farm?
Well, my husband retired there to run it as a farm in 1997 as a CSA, Community Supported Agriculture, and feeds between 450 and 500 families a year. And that's possible because we live near this very large urban population where people are trying to teach their children about the food system and where they have the resources to belong to a CSA.
You know, CSAs are, I forget the acronym stands for?
Community Supported Agriculture.
Okay. And you know, there's something, as we were talking about before the show started, that have, you know, an important purpose and serve a lot of people well. But on the other hand, in the bigger picture, when we're talking about as we go into this hour, they're just a very small part of the solution, a very small solution in a system that's really broken in pretty significant ways. Is that right?
That's right. And in fact, it's one of the reasons I wrote Foodopoly, because I work for Food and Water Watch, where we're trying to fundamentally change the food system and to stop the corporate control of our most important resources. And what we've seen is that we really need more people to be politically active. And what's happened with the very vibrant good food movement, which is, you know, we see it across the country, is that a lot of people now are focused on changing the food system for themselves and their family and even their community, which is fantastic, and we applaud that. But we're going to have to change the political system to have a food system that works for everyone, because we're not going to be able to just change it through CSAs and farmers markets, because the market's too unfair.
You know, it strikes me as I was reading the introduction to your book, a lot of what's happening in the realm of agriculture and food availability is very similar to what's happened to the news media in this country, in the sense that consolidation and just having a few people be able to take control of the system has really had a detrimental effect. And so just as we can see the very tangible effects in terms of newspapers that are dwindling and the quality going down and everything else, a lot of that's happening with food, but maybe isn't quite as visible to us.
Well, I think that's right. It's not visible to people because when they step into a grocery store, they literally see thousands of brands. But in reality, there are about 20 giant food processing companies that own a large number, in fact, most of those brands. I'm talking about companies like PepsiCo, Kraft, Tyson, you know, the largest food companies in the country. And then there are the grocery stores themselves. We have four giant chains that control, in some markets, 70 to 90% of grocery sales. Mm. Walmart's a good example. It's the largest grocery retailer in the country. One out of three grocery dollars are spent at Walmart. And then you look at the economic system and what that means. The Walmart heirs have as much wealth as the bottom 40% of Americans.
Yeah.
So this consolidation in food and many other industries is having a dramatic effect both on our economy and, in the case of food, on what people eat.
And to bring it home here to Wisconsin, what effect has this had on small family farms versus corporate farms?
Well, what we've seen in Wisconsin, where the dairy industry has been devastated, but across the country, we are losing farms at a rapid rate. And today, there's really very little interest in maintaining small and mid-sized farms, which are really the backbone of rural communities. And I think in part, this devastation of rural communities because of the destruction of agriculture has a lot to do with why our political system is in such bad shape.
So I know it's a subtle distinction when we say there's very little interest. Is that the political establishment that's been disinterested, or are the folks that are most affected in the small towns, the farmers themselves, the folks in urban centers who see that it's in our best interest to have these small farms? Are there not folks out there that are advocating and are concerned?
Well, I think it's the political establishment.
Yeah.
And that's been the case for decades. I mean, a long time ago, the elite decided that labor on farms should be replaced with capital, really from the 1940s on, and this has been happening. And today, when you really look at the U.S. Department of Agriculture's statistics on farmers, they're basically lying about how many farmers are left. We have fewer than a million full-time farmers left in this country. And if you look at the average income of a mid-sized farmer, it's really shocking. Just over $19,000. Mm. Half of that comes from government payments.
So is it just a system that is really not paying back all of the enormous effort anybody knows goes into a farm, the 24-hour cycle, the getting up in long hours, but somehow that's just not translating into tangible rewards for those folks who invest in that?
That is exactly right. And I think people in rural areas do want to farm. Lots of people in urban areas want to get back to food production. We know there's a huge movement in this country of young farmers. And we need to make lots of changes to make it possible for people to get back into agriculture. And one of the things that we really don't talk about in this country is the impact of consolidation on the marketplace.
Yeah.
And we live in this country where we're told that our economic system is based on competition. But when you look at all of the policies, the federal policies, everything is directed at allowing companies to become more and more consolidated.
So it's really leading us toward monopolies that are controlling more and more. It really isn't the exact opposite of any kind of a competitive environment, it sounds like.
That's exactly right. And, you know, I think the beer merger that's going on right now is a good example. And I think it's an example because we have lots of beer drinkers, and we have beer drinkers among different segments of the American population. And most people don't know that 80% of beer is produced by two foreign corporations, one Belgium, Anheuser-Busch InBev, and the other SAB Miller, which is controlled by interest in the U.K. And now the largest of those two, the Anheuser-Busch one, wants to acquire Corona's parent company.
Oh, my goodness.
And
yeah.
The reason they want to do that is Corona's been going up against Bud Light. And the way that beer pricing works is that the Anheuser-Busch Corporation sends a note out to SAB Miller and each year and says, we're going to be raising our prices this much this year. And then Miller raises their prices to match, and the duopoly controls pricing. And Corona hasn't, a Mexican-owned brand, yeah, hasn't gotten with the program. So now Anheuser-Busch wants to buy it. But what most people don't realize is that this has a real detrimental effect on the microbreweries.
Oh.
And there are about 2,000. It's about 6% of beer sales in the U.S.
Something very popular here. Yeah.
Right. But these companies, if they want to get into a grocery store or into a convenience store, they have to hitch their wagon to one of the big companies' distributors. And the big companies control their distributors, which are also becoming very consolidated. And they're buying up a lot of the microbreweries. So we think this is a really good example that people will get. And they'll get it with their pocketbook. And it's a good example of the consolidation that's not visible.
So it's like, you know, you were talking earlier about sort of the illusory nature of these thousands of items or brands that are on the shelf. There's really a few people that control things. But in case of the brewing industry, the same thing is true. You just have really a couple of big players, and they call the shots.
They own all the brands, and what they do, and it's the same with food, is they do niche marketing research, and they market to different segments of the population, and they even do this with organic food. Those 20 large companies I was talking about, 14 of them own the largest brands of the big organic companies. And so, you know, and that's niche marketing too. They know that they can make more money from organics. And so they do marketing to certain segments of the population at the same time that they lobby to weaken the organic standards.
Yeah. As we were talking earlier, I was telling you my mother grew up down in the Shenandoah Valley. One thing I forgot to tell you, I don't know why I didn't think of this, is her father was a grocer. Started with a small corner store in the 20s with his brothers, and then eventually had, you know, a chain of about a dozen stores all throughout Central Virginia. But he at one point was the president of the Independent Grocers Association. And this was a group, I think, that really was trying for a lot of the trends you were talking about, the positive trends of growing food locally, being able to make choices that are the best benefit of your customers. What's happened to that kind of ethos or that kind of movement in the modern day?
Well, there are some independent grocers left, the IGAs. I know that we have some in Virginia, but they have a very difficult time competing with the giant chains because the way that food is distributed, it benefits those who demand volume. And in fact, that's why we see consolidation going all the way down to the farm level.
Yeah.
Because when you have a big company like Walmart, they have so much market power that they really control even what these big brands do. You know, they, for instance, Walmart buys 1 billion pounds of beef every year. They want to deal with the largest meat packing companies like Tyson and the giant Brazilian company JBS. And those companies and the distributors, they don't want to bother with these small grocery stores. And if they do distribute, they charge a lot more money. And then it makes it impossible for the smaller grocers to actually compete. And actually, our traditional grocery stores like Safeway, Hy-Vee, those types of stores, they are having enormous trouble competing with the big brands like the Walmart, Kroger, which operates under many different names, Costco, and Target. Those are the four largest chains that dominate groceries in the United States now.
We have a question that one of our listeners had phoned in. And by the way, we want to invite all of you into this conversation. Please give us a call at 608-256-2001 to join in our conversation with Winona Howder. Again, Winona is here for a presentation tonight at the Goodman Center, but on the east side at 149 Wabisa Street, beginning at 7 o'clock. Her book is called Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America. Our caller's question states that in their humble opinion, the greatest threat to the food system is the use of futures contracts by investors, the price of grains going skyward. Does that ring a bell?
It absolutely does. And this doesn't just affect Americans. This affects people across the world. And when our grain markets were deregulated, and this has happened in a series of different deregulations, what happened is that it put enormous power in the speculative market. And we have companies like Cargill, ConAgra, giant food processors who are very active in this market, but they also need to buy these products to produce some of the foods and ingredients that they produce. We also have many speculators whose names we don't really know, we're not familiar with, who are just simply speculating on food. And there's an excellent new book out that looks at what happened in 2008 with this speculative market. It's called Bet the Farm by Frederick Kaufman, and I'd recommend that anyone who's interested in this issue read it. And what happens is the U.S. Grain markets really set the price for grains around the world. And so when the price goes way up, then it goes way up in developing countries that are where people are really dependent on these grains to feed people. And it's resulted in a tremendous amount of starvation. Now, something just related to that, these two of these giant grain traders and grain users, ConAgra, which is the 12th largest food processing company in the world, and Cargill, the Minnesotan private company, which is the 14th largest food processing company in the country, they've just announced a flour merger. They want to put together their milling operations in a new company called Argent that would control as much flour as is in one out of three slices of bread, which is going to mean that farmers are going to get lower prices because of the consolidation, and consumers are probably going to pay more for bread.
This conundrum of lower prices, which, of course, appeals to folks, and I've heard lots of folks, for example, say, well, it may be very PC for you to suggest that we should stay away from the Walmarts of the world and other things, but I'm on a limited income. My hours have been cut back. I have limited resources. I need to go where things are less expensive. How do you answer someone who's bringing up those basic concerns, and how do you convince them that it's in their long-term best interest to seek out other alternatives?
Well, let me take that from a couple of different ways. First of all, we always hear that these consolidations are bringing efficiency to the food system. And if you look at Walmart in particular and some of the how they brought down prices, a lot of those so-called efficiencies have already maxed out. I mean, and the grocery industry, a lot of the unions that are involved in delivering groceries from the meat packers, for instance, the unions have already been busted in a lot of ways for the butchers. A lot of those things that they've done to bring down prices happened before this last wave of consolidation. And in fact, the new waves of consolidation aren't bringing prices down any longer. In fact, groceries are going up. Over the last 10 years, they've gone up 3% every year. And you'll hear USDA say, well, Americans spend 9% of their disposable income on food. Well, we have to look at how they define disposable income. They count all pension benefits, all health care benefits, all food stamps, all women, infant, and children programs. Now, in my book, that's not disposable income. And then they divide everybody's, including the 1%, everybody's income with that. And when you actually look at, for instance, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, who I trust a lot more on this issue, they say that the bottom 20% of Americans actually spend almost 36% of their income on groceries. The bottom 40% of Americans spend about 17% of their income on groceries. So groceries are going up in price, and many people are spending more. And once Walmart drives everybody out of the grocery business, then we're going to see really high prices. And we've already seen that in many industries. Once you have no competition, there's no reason that anybody has to keep their prices low. This in large effect is about predatory pricing and bringing down the price of groceries. So it's really the opposite of having competition and trying to maintain fair prices.
So, I mean, it sounds like it's a basic problem that's wrong with so many systems in this country right now. It's greed and profit-driven to wring whatever profits you can out in the short term, but no concern for the longer term. And I think of folks like my grandfather that, you know, that did think ahead and did think of the long term, both in terms of the business, the community, the bigger picture. But unfortunately, that's not necessarily happening. So it's really people that have to come forward and reassert that those values are important again.
I think that's exactly right. And I mean, it's one of the reasons I wrote Foodopoly is I think that this growing food movement could be a way to politicize people and bring people in to the political debates and into elections, for that matter. And we need to do something about our democracy. And I think fixing our food system means fixing our democracy. But you talk about low-income people. We need to fix our democracy so that people's living standard is raised, so that people have a livable wage and aren't dependent on Walmart having low prices. I mean, the food system isn't going to fix poverty. It can help alleviate it as communities try to feed people, and these urban feeding programs and urban gardening and farming is wonderful, and we should do it. But this isn't going to fix the economic system and the stratification that's growing today and that needs to be addressed.
So we really have to step back, look at the big picture here. I want to, in just a moment, go back to a little bit of history that forms the foundation for a lot of what's happened here. But we actually have a question that's been phoned in. Maybe it's a little more forward-looking. And Dave asks, could our guest foreshadow 10 or 15 years into the future in terms of climate change, its effect on food security? And the second part of the question is, how can locally grown food help alleviate some of those challenges?
Well, I think that the challenges that climate change are going to bring in terms of both the impact of weather, drought, floods, erratic weather generally, and then with peak oil. I mean, we have to get off the oil diet, and oil is the basis for agribusiness, both in how we run our tractors and many of the inputs that farmers use. So I really think the only answer is to re-regionalize our food system. And I don't mean Walmart re-regionalizing our food system, as some have suggested. I mean actually addressing the issues over the next, you know, and I think it's going to take 20 years probably, addressing the consolidation and the reason that people no longer are able to produce food regionally that can help support the population. Because if we aren't able to do that, we're going to be in big trouble in the future. And we need a food system where people can grow many of the foods that they're dependent on or that we need to sustain ourselves And, you know, I think fruits and vegetables are a pretty good example of this.
Yeah.
I mean, the craziness of shipping in fruits and vegetables, even into the Midwest from California and from around the world during the months that those foods can be produced here. And we know that it's impossible for the farmers in the Midwest to compete with the cheap labor in places in the developing world or with the fabulous weather in California and the subsidized water there. We need to create a system that incentivizes growing those foods when it's possible to do so. And, you know, something interesting I found out when I was writing Foodopoly, Montana was self-sufficient until the 1950s. Now, I'm not suggesting that we should all go back and just eat dried or canned vegetables, but I think that we do need to, in the future, be a lot more realistic about the foods that we eat in the winter months. And I'm not saying that we would never ship foods from places like California.
Yeah.
But we need to, you know, who needs those hard strawberries? We need some common sense in the foods we eat. And I think it's going to take some of these major impacts, like climate change, to really bring us to where people are willing to do it. But we have to force our political leaders to create the kind of marketplace that's necessary to do this.
So it's a smaller footprint in some ways is part of it.
Yeah, exactly.
And then that's the local part. But, of course, there's also, as you're alluding to, we can't be parochial. We can't just act in our own area or our own interest. We've got to see the bigger picture here. That's a role for government. And people encouraging government to do the right thing, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, we have this enormous piece of legislation that passes every 5 years called the Farm Bill, with less than a million farmers left in this country. We should call it the Food Bill, with over 300 million people being dependent on the food that's created from these policies. We need substantial reform in this legislation. We need things like a competition title, and we need our federal government. Congress could order this. We need to do a retrospective examination of what the consolidation in the food industry has done both to consumers and to farmers.
Yeah.
And to make any of these things happen, we are going to have activate people across this country, not just on the coasts and or in the more progressive urban areas. We need to be out there organizing and getting people involved across the country if we're really going to take back our democracy.
As an organizer, I'm especially vested in hearing about how we do that in practice. So we'll spend our last half hour dealing with that in substantial measure. But for those of you who are just joining us here in midstream, our guest is Winona Howder. She's the author of Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America. Winona is going to be speaking at an event sponsored in part by the Center for Media and Democracy. And that's tonight at 7 o'clock at the Goodman Center, 149 Wabisa Street on Madison's East Side. And we invite you to join in our conversation by calling us at 608-256-2001. And we do believe we have a couple of callers on the line. Caller, what is your comment or question for Winona Howder?
Hi. Okay, a couple of comments. One is that there is also the consolidation of ownership of seeds, which Monsanto is certainly doing its part to make kind of the way of the world. And with our free trade agreements, we are foisting our policies and our corporations' policies on the poor peoples of the world who are being forced to buy seeds that are patent protected and which require inputs that are petroleum based and that do not allow the farmer to really be in control of his or her crop, but are basically subservient to Monsanto or whichever corporation is selling them the seeds and the inputs that they need to grow those crops. And I guess that's all I want to say.
Thanks. All right. Thank you for your question.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I mean, we have three companies in the world that really control most seeds. And this consolidation is having a dreadful effect on the global south, the developing world. And our own State Department has forced a lot of these policies down the throats of people in these countries and the peasant farmers who bear the brunt of it. And I think that here in the U.S., one of the things that I'm excited about is seeing the movement across the country in more than 30 states to label genetically engineered food, because I think that we need to take some of the political power, a lot of the political power, away from companies like Monsanto that have had such a detrimental effect on our food system and on food systems around the world. And we're really in a battle now with Monsanto and the biotech industry over having many, many, many more genetically engineered foods, because in the recent past, it's been mostly the ingredients of processed foods that have been genetically engineered. So I'm talking about corn and soy, and then cotton for cottonseed oil, canola for canola oil. These are main ingredients in processed foods. But now the biotech industry is in a frenzy to get the foods that actually end up on our plates genetically engineered. So we've seen sweet corn legalized in the last year. We're in a major battle over genetically engineered salmon right now. And the FDA hasn't acted to legalize it yet because of the huge grassroots movement over the last 2 years. And we now have just a couple of weeks left in the comment period for telling the FDA that we don't want genetically engineered salmon. And I urge everyone who hasn't commented to do so. One way you can do so that's kind of easy is to go to the front page of our Food and Water Watch website, foodandwaterwatch.org, and you can get your comment directly into the FDA. But these companies are the effect on seeds is especially very concerning, because we're talking about the basic things that we need to feed ourselves in the future.
I heard someone from a local CSA talk about his pride in, I think it was in the case of maybe cucumbers or something, in terms of developing, rather making sure that there were a wide variety of seed types that went into his crops and other things. But he was contrasting that with the trend you're talking about, that corporate America doesn't necessarily see the value, doesn't see the longer-term impact that using a limited number of seeds and then having to rely on these, you know, these created artificial type things, you know, has. So
definitely a concern. I mean, this a lot of the people in corporate America and, you know, our policymakers are technocrats. They really think the technology is the answer. And they see no problem with narrowing the number of seeds. And this is just common sense tells us that this is not a good idea and that we need diverse seeds. We need seeds that have over a long period of time been developed for different parts of the globe. And this is one of the sick things about companies like Monsanto trying to force both their seeds and the processed foods that the processed food industry wants to sell into countries around the world. And they've viewed Africa as the last frontier. And a lot of this is just, well, most of it, it's about creating a market for these products.
All right. Once again, our guest for the remainder of the hour is Winona Howder. She's the executive director of Food and Water Watch and the author Foodopoly, the battle over the future of food and farming in America. You can come see Winona tonight at the Goodman Center at 149 Wabisa Street on the east side. It's 7 o'clock in an event co-sponsored by Center for Media and Democracy. We have another caller on the line. Your comment, your question for Winona Howder, please. Go ahead, caller.
Yes. I was a organic farmer in Kansas for a number of years and went to work as a marketer for an organic co-op, and now live in Madison, but still market for this co-op of about 100 farmers. And my experience in having been a farmer and now on the other side representing them in the marketplace is that the cooperative structure is still probably the best organizational structure for farmers to basically have some kind of a size that can go into the marketplace with their products and still compete against some of the large, corporate muscle and the large scale farmers that they tend to like to encourage. And one thing, being an organic, producing organic grains, our pricing structure is basically, if you take the general rule of thumb, is about double the conventional market prices. Sometimes it trebles, depending on, you know, demand and the conditions it's produced under. But what we're finding is that price structure is warranted, and be warranted in the conventional marketplace if you were trying to stimulate entry of young farmers, because farming is it's a long deal. It's like a 30 to 40 year structure that you're involved in, and you carry a lot of debt that's going to pay off later on when the debt is cleared, and that's when you will seek the rewards that the high price will give you. But you need a high price at the start of the deal, because you've got to retire this debt and still be able to cover bases to live. So we really need to figure out that if we want small, viable farms that can, you know, look like the type of farm that people want to have, we got to have pricing structure that gets the farmer, well, we call it the living wage of farming. I mean, it's sort of like the living wage of a worker. The farmer has to have a living wage, and that living wage is higher than what commodities are getting now.
Caller, we'll get Winona's response in just a second, but I want to I also have some roots in Kansas, with my parents having lived in Wichita for this past 30 years, and grandfather from Lawrence. But you know, what's the matter with Kansas conundrum that book brought up? I wonder if you have some thoughts on how folks in places like Kansas, Wisconsin, can become invested in a political process or a grassroots movement that moves them to a place where they do have power, they do have a voice, and they can counter some of these trends. Do you have a sense of how we can accomplish that? Are you still there, caller? All right. Well, maybe have you get your perceptions on that as well. Thanks.
Well, first of all, I couldn't agree more than about the co-op structure. I think we do need to have a co-op structure to really give farmers a chance in the marketplace. But a real co-op where all of the farmers share the benefits, not like we see in the dairy industry where we have four co-ops that collect milk, and along with Dean, the largest milk distributor and processor in the country, they control about 80% of milk sales. And these so-called dairy co-ops, they discriminate against the smaller members of the co-op, and they give the fees and the benefits to the larger guys. So I think co-ops like the one that the caller spoke of are tremendous and need to be encouraged. Now, I think one of the problems in addressing food policy and getting people active on the farm food bill is that in too many cases, environmentalists have been pitted against farmers. Mm. And it's one of the reasons I wrote Foodopoly, because we hear a lot about subsidies and that subsidies are the biggest issue. But really what the issue is that farmers don't make the cost of production, and that deregulation, the final blow came in 1996. This is for grain farmers.
Yeah.
And farmers have never been able to really recover from that. And so more and more farmers go out of business, and then there's more consolidation in farming and more vertical integration with the companies that benefit from this kind of system. So I think that we need to work in these states with policies that are going to benefit farmers in the short term. And we need to realize that farmers have to get the cost of production, and that we can't just talk about these more abstract issues like subsidies and really blaming farmers. So often farmers are blamed for the problems with our food system, and farmers are as much victims as anyone else.
Well, I think one of the things that did happen with the Wisconsin Uprising and some other movements that have happened, for example, coalition work within the Wisconsin Network for Peace and Justice is bringing farmers and environmentalists together. And you're right. I think when they sit at the same table, they see there's more common cause than there is anything else.
Yeah.
We have a couple of other callers on the line. Again, I invite you all to join in this conversation, 608-256-2001. Caller, what's your comment or question for our guest, Winona Howder?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Yeah. To comment, I attended public hearings back in the 90s in the state capitol here regarding RGBH, BST, BGH. I mean, how Monsanto, the media, gets away with calling BST, BGH for marketing purposes. I don't drink hardly any milk anymore. I had a reaction. I used to drink a gallon of milk a day. I used to whole vitamin D milk. I walk out of the grocery store and half of the gallon wouldn't make it to the car. And I had a reaction back in like 1989, 88. I mean, I had four knuckle-sized pustules break out of my body. And my wife took a look at me. She says, "You ever think about the dairy that you consume?" Mm. And at any rate, I cut back on my dairy. In September, when the situation had subsided, I saw an article in the Wisconsin State Journal that said that the University of Wisconsin had released BST product into the public place unbeknownst. And when I attended this hearing in Madison, I mean, Monsanto was there, and all these corporate operations. I mean, kudos to the Greene County farmers who, I mean, the only reason BGH got slowed down was those people stood 300 deep on the steps of the Capitol because they saw what it was doing to their cheeses and their cows. And, but, I mean, when I attended this hearing, they actually wanted to do away with the First Amendment. They wanted to tell people they didn't have the right to properly label their food. And there were 20 legislators sitting there wasting a day over the First Amendment. If you're not using the stuff, you have the right to market it as such. How much more simple can you get about that?
All right.
And, but at any rate, about 10 years ago, you had an Iowa pig farmer on. He was a third-generation Iowa pig farmer, and he said they almost went out of business because of the GAR seed corn event, when they introduced a mycotoxin into the fourth event in their seed corn. Why isn't this national news? Right now, one of our military advisors, top scientists, informed the FDA 6 months in advance of Monsanto's application on their beet and their alfalfa that he's seeing pathologens in both these products that he's never seen before in nature. And he said this should be considered an emergency alert to them. And 6 months later, I understand they just gave Monsanto approval.
All right. Let me see if I can get an answer for you. We should just make sure everybody is up on acronyms. So BGH, bovine growth hormone.
Right. This is a hormone that is injected into cows to up their milk production. And it actually wears out the cows that are usually milked three times a day. Then a cow used to live for about 20 years. These poor cows live for maybe 3 years, and then they end up as hamburger. And there are a lot of health issues associated with this. And what's happened in the U.S. is because there has been so much publicity about the potential health effects, a lot of the big big guys in the grocery industry, companies like Starbucks, there have been campaigns to make them stop using milk that's produced with this hormone. And so now there's very little of this being sold in the U.S., and Monsanto sold the right to use this hormone to the Eli Lilly company, and unfortunately now it's being used in the developing world. But, you know, I think the the reason that the biotech industry has so much power in all of these issues and has been able to do basically what it wants is because of how much money it spends and campaign contributions and lobbying. At Food and Water Watch, we did a report a year or so ago, and we found that over a 10-year period, they spent about $572 million on lobbying and campaign contributions. They have about 100 lobby shops in Washington. Mm. They hired 13 former members of Congress and 100 former staffers for the White House and for members of Congress. And this really is why they have undue influence on our legislatures, on Congress, and on the regulatory agencies.
So it's another Washington problem. Too much power on K Street and not enough on Pennsylvania Avenue.
That's right, right.
All right. We have another caller. What is your comment or question for Winona Howder, please?
I'm calling in follow-up to the discussion a little earlier about the environment, global warming, and farmers and how that all ties together. And right now, the big corporations are heavily subsidized by low fuel costs. And what results is they can transport their products anywhere they want at relatively low cost. They're not paying for all the environmental damage caused by their fuel, whether it be, you know, initially at the pumps and mines or the air pollution that's caused by burning it, including greenhouse gases. And as a result, the farmer has to compete with the price that's very low for them, not high enough to make a living, because they're, even though they're not using hardly any fuel in their operations, I mean, they're using some, but they're not transporting their products over to California or something, and as a result, we're using way too much fuel, burning it in these vehicles to transport all this food, way you know, to Chile. We get stuff from Chile here in Madison, and it's relatively cheap.
Okay, did you have a specific question, or should we just get it?
Well, I think we got to go to our government and mm-hmm. get a tax, a carbon tax on the fuel, and then the money that's raised from those taxes should be funneled back to people that are not using so much fuel right now.
All right, let's get a response to that.
They're driving less. They're not flying all over the place for vacations.
All right. Thanks for your question. Go ahead.
I think cheap transportation costs are one of the ways that the food processors are able to ship foods around the world. I think there are a lot of reasons that farmers are unable to produce food in a way that that they can make a living.
Yeah.
And it has to do this global food situation where food is transported from faraway locations has a lot to do with a lot of the public policies that happened in the mid-1990s, the trade agreements, for instance. That really jump-started the ability to offshore food production. And we see more trade agreements like the Trans-Pacific Partnership now being negotiated. You look at what it costs to produce food in some of the developing nations as compared to here, and of course it's going to be cheaper. Farmers also have to pay a lot for the inputs. So actually for farmers, fuel costs are going up. The cost of fertilizer is going up. The cost of seeds is going up dramatically. And the deregulation that also took place in the mid-1990s to go along with these trade agreements has had a lot to do why farmers can't compete. And any large corporation that provides food to grocery chains, they have to have an operation overseas as well as an operation here in the United States. And I'm talking about in fruit and vegetable production. If you have an operation in California, the consolidation means that there are fewer farms producing food there and that they're going to have an operation somewhere overseas to export crops into the United States.
In terms of the connection with global warming, one of the points I think you made in your introduction to the book was that there are some of these multinational firms that are positioning themselves to take advantage in terms of profits that will be wrought when the different growth, the belts where growth of different crops occur and other things. They're trying to be strategic about that somehow in a way that would make profit out of what is a very disturbing situation for the world.
Well, I think that's right, and we can look at how land prices are going up even here in the Midwest, where companies and investors are purchasing land for the future, for speculation in the future. We see this around the world where land and water resources are being purchased, and we know that in coming decades that there is going to be water scarcity. And so it's very frightening to see these companies actually getting control of water resources, and it's going to have an impact not just on water availability for drinking, but it's also going to be for food production. And then I think the other thing that's happening is because farmers aren't able to make a living, and I'm talking about the United States now, we see the industries like the natural gas industry going in to extract, to frack rural areas that should be producing our food. And we basically are substituting extractive industries for food production, and it's all for short-term profit.
All right. In our final minutes here, I want to just first of all make sure that folks are aware of this opportunity to hear you and to be in dialogue with you tonight, and that's at 7 o'clock at the Goodman Center at 149 Wabisa Street. Again, Winona Howder will be there, again, she'll be talking about her book, Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America. Other ways that you can find out more about her and her important work, the Food and Water Watch website, which is
foodandwaterwatch.org.
And she's also here in the context of work with the Center for Media and Democracy. She's a regular contributor to prwatch.org as well. So another place you can find more information. I'm going to do kind of a sweeping question here in just a couple minutes, see if we can get your response. But you open the book talking about this phenomenon, getting the boys off the farm, things that were happening post-Depression, New Deal, post-World War II, that folks, the powers that be had decided, we've got to take all of these farm workers and put them into the industrial sector. Again, it sounds like it's a pattern that a small group of people trying to make the decisions for the rest of us, not in our own best interest. So how do we turn that around in the here now?
Well, I think there's no replacement for grassroots organizing. We really have to get people out working in their communities, looking for candidates to run for office. When people get elected, we have to hold them accountable. And I think we need some accountability in the political parties. Like the Democratic Party is not always accountable to its base, and it's going to take mass activism amongst its constituency to really get this political system back actually doing what the people want. And there is no replacement for doing things at the state level so that next time redistricting happens, that we can have a better Congress.
Yeah.
So I think that it's important, these state campaigns, and that accountability really starts at the local and state level. And before we run out of time, I want to really thank the Center for Media Democracy. They do a tremendous amount of fantastic work, and Madison is very fortunate to have them here in the community.
Yeah, and I think one of the other things that they help establish, it's a theme throughout what you've been talking about, is the intersectionality of things like the environmental movement, fracking, and all of these things all tied together, all of the things that brought people together at the Wisconsin Capitol, are resonant with this issue of food.
That's right, and it's a real problem when we're all in our own silos and we're not having the cross-fertilization that's necessary, because what we're really talking about is fighting for our democracy and actually having a democracy where people are playing a major role in what the decisions are that our policymakers are legislating. And right now, they aren't doing what the people want.
All right. Thank you so much for being our guest this hour. Winona Howder is the author of Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America. Again, you can find out more information about the important work she's doing at the website of Food and Water Watch. And then tonight at 7 o'clock at the Goodman Center at 149 Wabisa Street, she'll be speaking, book reading, and a chance for you to engage in conversation with her at 7 o'clock. This event, again, sponsored by the Center for Media and Democracy. Winona, thank you so much for joining us.
I really enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
Great pleasure. We hope to have you on again. And this is John Quinlan with The Public Affair. Have a good week. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision fly by helicopters in the night. Attempt triangulation of our station in the fight. Straight from the base, deep down, low precision. High crime treason, we broadcast in sedition. Like the Wall Street Morning Afternoon Edition. Commandeering airwaves from under.